The coffee was already there when I arrived. Oat milk cortado, still hot. The cup placed at the exact spot on his kitchen island where I always sit. He was in the other room on a call. And he smiled at me through the glass wall of his office and held up one finger, just a minute. And I sat down with my coffee and thought, this is what it feels like to be known. I was 31. I worked in project management at an architecture firm in a city I'd moved to 4 years before for a job and stayed in because leaving felt like admitting defeat. I was competent at work, functional in my apartment, and quietly hollow in that particular way that functional, competent people get when they've been excellent at every external metric for so long that they've forgotten to track the internal ones. I didn't know what I wanted. I knew what I was supposed to want. I had been performing the version of my life that would photograph well for 6 years, and I had gotten very good at it. David was 43. He worked in private equity, which I barely understood, and he moved through the world with the particular ease of someone who has never had to justify themselves to anyone who mattered. We met at an industry event my firm attended. He found me in the corner, nursing a glass of wine and pretending to be on my phone, and he said something so specific about the presentation that had just concluded, something that required genuine attention to the material, that I looked up, caught off guard by competence. We talked for 2 hours. He sent me a LinkedIn message the next morning with a book recommendation. That was how it started. Not with a compliment, with evidence that he had been listening. The cortado thing began in the third week. He had noticed. He told me later, much later, when he was explaining himself in the way that people explain themselves when they are caught doing something they've decided to call a personality trait rather than a strategy. He had noticed that I always ordered the same thing when we got coffee together. He began having it ready. Not always. That was the part I didn't understand at the time. If it had been every time, it would have felt prescribed. It was maybe every third or fourth time. Enough to feel like devotion, not enough to feel like surveillance. I told my friend Margot about it in week 5. I told her he always had my coffee ready. She said, "That's romantic." I said, "I know. We were both right. Those two things can be true simultaneously." He had an orbit. That's the word I kept using when I tried to describe him to people who didn't know him. And I realize now it was accurate in ways I wasn't intending. There were people who circled him. Clients, former colleagues, women he'd dated who remained inexplicably warm toward him, friends who seemed to compete for his attention without acknowledging they were competing. Being let into that orbit felt like being admitted somewhere exclusive. He introduced me at dinner parties as though my presence was a matter of consequence. He asked my opinion in front of people in ways that demonstrated he had actually read the thing I'd mentioned. He made me feel in professional and social settings like someone who mattered. I understand now that this was data collection, dressed as admiration. In week 9, he canceled plans with a business contact to take me to a gallery opening I'd mentioned offhandedly 2 weeks before. Not a major sacrifice, a dinner he could reschedule. But he framed it as a choice he'd made, because being with me mattered more. I filed that moment in the category of evidence that this was real. That was the function of the gesture, not the gallery, the filing. By month 4, I was building my social life around his schedule, without having consciously decided to do so. His friends were now my primary social contact outside work. The gallery openings, the dinners, the weekends away, all of them orbited his calendar. I had told myself this was just what happens when you're in a serious relationship, which is true, and I had told myself that the reason I was seeing less of my own people was logistics and distance and the natural drift of adult friendships, which is also partially true. And I had told myself that his social world was more interesting than mine, which I genuinely believed and which was the most useful thing he'd ever done to me. He became vulnerable in month 5. That was the pivot. He told me about his first marriage, brief, painful, his fault, he said. He'd been unavailable, he'd prioritized work over connection, and watching him tell me this story, I felt something shift. Vulnerability from someone who moves through the world that easily feels like a gift. like access to the real person underneath the competence. I told myself that a man who can admit his failures is a man who has grown from them. This is a reasonable thing to believe. It is also one of the primary tools. I canceled Christmas. I had a flight home booked for the 23rd. Tickets purchased in September. My parents expected me. My younger brother, who I barely saw, expected me. David told me on the 20th that he was struggling. He used that word, struggling, with something he'd received news about that week. Nothing he could fully explain yet. He needed me there. He said he didn't want to ask me to stay, but he needed me there. I canceled the flight. I called my parents and gave them an excuse that wasn't quite a lie and wasn't quite the truth. I stayed with him for Christmas in his apartment, where he was fine within 36 hours, recovered from whatever had been struggling him, and we had a quiet, pleasant holiday during which he cooked well and we walked in the cold, and I told myself this was intimacy. This is what it looks like when you choose someone, I told myself. This is what it feels like to be in a real relationship. My mother called me after the new year and asked, very carefully, whether I was all right. Not whether I was happy. Whether I was all right. Those are different questions. And my mother knew enough to ask the right one. I told her I was wonderful. The Cortado was still appearing. The dinners were still excellent. He still introduced me to people as though my presence was notable. Everything on the surface was performing exactly as advertised. What I couldn't explain to my mother, what I couldn't explain to myself for another 4 months, was that I had stopped knowing what I wanted that wasn't filtered through what he wanted, what I thought about work that he hadn't first framed for me, what I thought about myself that he hadn't first reflected back to me, shaped slightly, returned in a version that was more useful to him. The oat milk cortado still appeared, on a variable schedule, placed at the exact spot on his kitchen island, warm, waiting, the temperature always exactly right. I had stopped noticing it as a gift. I had started noticing it as something I depended on. I was not sure when the transition had happened. I was not sure it mattered which came first. The boundary I had told Margot I would never cross, the one I'd said out loud in month 2 because saying it out loud felt like protection. I will not cancel on my family for a relationship, sat somewhere in my recent history, unremarkable, crossed without ceremony on December 20th when David said he needed me there. There is a particular quietness that descends when you realize the version of yourself you've been performing for the last 6 months is not quite yours. Not loud. Not dramatic. Just the faint, disorienting sensation of looking for something that used to be in a familiar place and finding the space where it was still warm, as if it had just been moved. The coffee was always there when I arrived. That's still what I remember first. The coffee, and how specific it felt. How seen it made me feel. I know now what that specificity actually was. I'm not sure knowing changes how good it felt before I knew. Was the warmth real? Or was it just precise enough to feel that way?